everyone. Welcome to the Friday Gallery Talk. So we have Melissa Ho, the assistant curator here, who organized Dark Matters, the show, the collection show on the lower level with our another colleague, Mika Yoshitake. And she's going to be talking today about the Morris Lewis painting, Charm Journal, Fire Written Number 1. So she comes to us from Philadelphia Museum of Art, MoMA, and has taught at the Corcoran as well. So we're happy to have here today.
So first of all, thank you for joining me today for this talk. This is a recent acquisition. It was a gift to the museum in 2011. And for those of you who are familiar with Morris Lewis's work, you might be surprised by the appearance of this painting. And it's called, as Jessica said, Charred Journal, Fire Written One. And it is, in fact, a very rare example of early work by Lewis. Like a lot of artists, he destroyed a lot of his early work, and so there's very little that still is around that predates 1952. This painting is dated 1951. And the Morris Lewis that we are familiar with, of course, created paintings that are characterized by large scale, the use of raw canvas, and most of all, vibrant, sensuous color. Probably his most famous series involved beautiful, translucent layers of color, or very, very vibrant bands or streams of color that come down from the tops and the sides of his paintings. And what do we have here? It is a relatively small work. It's a pretty traditional easel-sized canvas. And it has a very pared-down palette of basically black and white. And the composition is a combination of the gestural and what I'll call the calligraphic, because you actually can see where he's intentionally written identifiable numerals, letters. You can see an X, you can see a 3, some shapes. Possibly this is a 6. And this is part of a series of 7 works of similar appearance, and all of them feature some element of readable type. Then there's the title, which is quite unusual, Charred Journal, Fire Written One. Most of Lewis's later work, he actually didn't title. He wasn't so interested in assigning titles to his paintings. And in fact, he generally didn't assign titles until work was about to leave his studio and be put on exhibition. And in many cases, he solicited suggestions from friends for titles. And so a lot of the titles that we're familiar with his work, were not necessarily assigned by him, and that's especially true insofar as there's a lot of his work, he died quite young, that only was exhibited after his death. And so in those cases, titles were assigned posthumously and in a pretty systematic way, which was basically intended simply to group the works into series. So for instance, his veil paintings were all assigned titles that were Hebrew letters. His unfurls were given Greek letters. And this was just a system that his widow and his estate came up with to identify the pieces. This is a rare instance where we do know that Lewis was involved in generating the title. And so we can take some significance from this. And it was included in his very first solo show, which was in 1953. It was at a place called the Washington Center Workshop of the Arts. And it doesn't exist anymore, but it used to be on Mass Ave near DuPont Circle. It was a artist-run space that primarily served as a school. They served, they did adult education art classes, basically. And they also had a gallery space. And he generated the title and spoke about the meaning of these works with the director of the workshop and his wife. So we do know a little bit about his intentions. And the words sound extremely specific and deliberate, and I say that partly because there's something a little bit unwieldy about them. The title doesn't exactly trip off your tongue. It's a little bit of a mouthful in a weird way. Charred Journal, Fire Written One. So we know that he's choosing these very specifically. He's trying to draw up, you feel like he's making a point of raising this imagery of, on the one hand, burning and fire, and on the other hand, something that is written, a journal. So what is all this about? There's many things that we can talk about why this is stands out from the other work that we know by Lewis. First of all, there's the chronology. This was made in 1951, as I said, which is before Morris Lewis famously made a visit with his friend Kenneth Noland, another painter from what we've now come to call the Washington Color School, and the very influential modernist critic Clement Greenberg, who would become a really important supporter of the Washington Color School painters. They were all in New York together in 1953 and visited the studio of Helen Frankenthaler. And that was where Lewis and Noland first saw her painting Mountains and Sea, which is from 1952. And it's in the collection of the National Gallery of the Art, and it's often on view there, so some of you may have seen it. It was the first example of a work that used a raw canvas ground, by which I mean the fabric support was not primed, so it's just plain fabric, and Frankenthaler stained that canvas with paint. And it was seeing that Frankenthaler's innovation that inspired Lewis and sort of unleashed this whole body of work that followed after 1953. Now, this is before 1953, and what this work shows is Lewis's sympathy with an older generation of New York School painting, what we usually call the first generation of abstract expressionists. And in fact, in terms of dates, Morris Lewis was born in 1912, which makes him a direct contemporary of Jackson Pollock. So he was close in age to some of the younger first generation ABEX painters. And you can absolutely see the influence of Pollock's accomplishments in a work like this in terms of the gesture, in using line as form. And if you think about early Pollock, which was very pictographic, there's a connection there too with Morris Lewis's use of symbol here. There's also a connection in terms of palette. And in the early 50s, black was a color that was really favored by a lot of, the buzzword then would have been advanced modern painters of the time. And I'm thinking here of artists like Willem de Kooning, Adolf Gottlieb, Gorky, who we know that Lewis met in the 30s when at that time he was living in New York. And many of these artists turn to black and to white as a way of sort of getting back down to basics, of sort of getting to the fundamentals of their art, and in many cases also symbolically as a way of signaling a tragic existential theme. And so that generation of artists is not at all backing away from a symbolic reference here of black as signaling destruction or mourning or void. Another example of this idea to bring up, and I do because it's a rare instance where we know that Lewis himself commented on this work, is Picasso's Guernica from 1937, which is a famously black, white, and gray painting that was Picasso's response to the violence and the tragedy of the Spanish Civil War. It was a figurative painting, but it also had this very stark palette. And as I said, Lewis, who didn't leave a lot of written essays or even studio notes or anything behind, he did mention Guernica in his writings and remarked upon how it was that with Picasso, it was the absence of color in Guernica that gave it so much force and made that painting so shocking. And it's fair to say that Lewis is using a similar tactic here, because although it's not at all obvious at first glance, this is a painting that is trying to address history and cultural memory. Lewis talked about this series, The Charred Journals, as a response to the Holocaust, and specifically referencing in the title with the journal and the word written, in fire written, he's referencing the Nazi book burnings of the early 30s. Now, of course, there's also book burnings happening in the U.S. In the McCarthy era, the early 1950s, which is when this painting dates from, but I don't know if Morris Lewis, how much he may or may not have known about those book burnings happening. But certainly he talked about relating this to the Nazi book burnings. And in terms of what we're looking at, you can see that he is getting this effect of charred pages in the background. And when you look at it carefully, you can kind of reconstruct a little bit of his process. It seems like he laid down, if you see on the edge, you can come and look later maybe, you can make out that probably the first color laid down was a layer of yellow, followed by a very, very pale layer, possibly white or a slightly tinted white, and then finally this black, all of which is applied in these vertical strokes. And are kind of, the colors are sort of melting into each other. Then, and we have this from an account by a friend who, I don't know that he was present at the time that this painting was made, because in general Lewis was quite solitary and secretive about his work in the studio, but apparently, at least from an account from Lewis, it's been said that he laid lengths of toilet paper onto that wet ground, possibly then painted over that as well, and then pulled it up. And that's where this sort of grid-like effect comes from. And then, of course, he would have painted the very calligraphic portions with the canvas laid on the floor, working above it. Again, this is very much an echo of Pollock's working method, dripping that white paint off of maybe a stick, maybe a brush. I've been told by one of our painting conservators that the pale color here of those, of the writing and the gestural parts, is actually probably the paint turning color a bit from age. And she thinks that when it was first painted, it was probably bright white. So one of the things I think is really interesting about this piece is that it both functions as a modern abstract painting, non-referential abstract painting, and with this imagery of charred, ruined pages. So it's both abstract in its aspirations and social and historical in its aspirations. And that last part is really in contrast to how modernist critics following Clement Greenberg, and of course Greenberg himself, like to talk about painting and in particular about Lewis's work. Greenberg, who believed that all media should become increasingly more self-referential, increasingly more each about themselves, praised Lewis's work because of its qualities of being non-associative, because of its qualities of being paint that's about paint and nothing else. But here we have Lewis very clearly signaling his moral and political concerns as an artist, and I think that's really fascinating. I also think it's extraordinary because there are, I can't think of any earlier examples of an artist trying to engage the trauma of the Holocaust through abstraction. And there have been many since, arguably Barnett Newman's Station of the Cross, which is also at the National Gallery of Art, which also uses a very pared-down palette of black and white. And, of course, later examples still, works like Peter Eisenman's Memorial to the Holocaust in Berlin, all use a non-referential, abstract vocabulary to try to grapple with the Holocaust. And Lewis is the earliest example I can think of. And in many ways that, you know, using abstraction for this subject matter makes sense insofar as it's signaling the, you know, the profound incomprehensibility of something like the Holocaust. In you know, it's a topic that it's difficult to grapple with, perhaps through conventional representation. And perhaps there's also an effort here being made to help universalize that tragedy, and by using an abstract language, that's part of the value of abstraction has long been this idea that it has universal ability to communicate. It's taking the Holocaust from being a Jewish tragedy to being a more generally human, universal tragedy. Something also I wanted to say about the title, the word following the subtitle, perhaps you could call it the fire ridden. I think this is also a signal to how Jewish identity is playing into this piece. And because Greenberg's interpretation of Lewis was so powerful for so long, Jewish identity is something that people did not address with Lewis really until the 90s. And this body of work in particular was not shown together again since when it was first exhibited in 1953 until 1997, when the series was reunited in New York at the Jewish Museum. So it's only recent scholarship that's kind of grappling with this, but Fire Ridden would seem to be a reference perhaps to one of the origin myths of the Torah, the idea that the words of the Torah were first appeared written in white fire, and that the spoken tradition of the word first appeared in words of black fire. Incidentally, those are titles that were used by Newman, another secular Jew New York artist who worked in abstract mode for some of his pieces. So there's this idea of the Jewish book being born in letters of fire. There's also the story of Moses coming down from Mount Sinai with the commandments on tablets. And the first time he comes down and sees the Israelites worshiping the golden calf, he throws down the tablets and smashes them. But before they smash, the words fly away and survive. So there's also this idea of the word being eternal, even though the material support can be destroyed. So on the one hand, there's something very solemn about the imagery of these books being burned and destroyed, but there's certainly an element here of struggle and resistance, of the idea that the spirit is eternal, it's not going to get destroyed no matter how many books are burned. And so it's depending on the cultural references that you're bringing to this work, you can see this actually as a both an optimistic and a work sort of warning and referencing a very dark period. So I found this to be quite a fascinating piece, and we're so lucky because we have a really great array of Morris Lewis paintings in our collection, and this one really sort of rounds out the full career at this point, to have a pre-1953 painting. So it's a tremendous gift to the museum, and I'm so happy that I was able to put it on view as part of this exhibition. Thanks for coming out, everybody.